103.9. This is Triangulation. Radio Romero streaming live from Brooklyn. Right now we're listening to Mitchell Akiyama from Hope That Lines Don't Cross. And we have in the studio live Kenneth Kirshner and Andy Graydon. Both going to perform a little bit, some work from their catalog, and have some discussion. So thanks again for tuning in. This is free103.9.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
103.9. This is Radio Ruido. And we are listening to Mem 1. It's from Los Angeles. Big up Area C. Big up Listen Space, Ben Owen. Wonderful show a few weeks back. Also, big up Brian Eubanks, Andrew Lofkus for the show this past Friday at Listen Space. We're here every Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m. And tonight we have special guests Kenneth Kirshner and Andy Graydon. We're just setting up. We'll do some more introductions in a moment. And we'll do some transducing through the medium of digital audio. So thanks, free 103.9.org.
I'll set you up with a question or something.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, we'll just talk.
Come up with some sort of rationale for playing something or other.
Free 103.9, this is Triangulation, and we are here with Andy Graydon and Kenneth Kirshner, good friends and collaborators. I'll start with Kenneth has released a number of works on the label 12K based on piano, the space between gestures, and both analog and digital processing. And at a point worked with Andy, asked him to help remix a piece. And Andy has been working with Field Recordings, digital synthesis, and also explorations of time and space and how digital media helps us interpret these things and also forms boundaries about them. So we're going to turn the stage over to them, let them talk, and play some of the sounds we love. This is Free 103.9.org.
Okay.
Here we are.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Tom. Hi, Andy.
So, I thought that was what Tom was saying about this idea of a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
is a nice place to start. I know that one of the things I was interested in and asking you to come in and have us talk a little bit,
mm-hmm.
is this idea that one thing that I'm working a lot with sound right now is are recordings of sound spaces,
mm-hmm.
and recording the kind of the frame, you might say,
yeah.
of the sound as a sort of an empty set,
mm-hmm.
In and around what people might be attending to.
Right.
You, in different ways, seem very interested and very attentive and focused on things that are ordinarily moved outside, into a frame or
yep.
beyond the focus of sound.
Yeah.
So I thought one thing to start by talking about is your relationship to the space of recording.
Right. Well, that's brings us to one of the pieces we have here, which I brought along. This is from what we call the piano sketch for Post Piano 2, which was an album that Taylor Dupree and I did in 2005. Does that sound correct? I think that's what it is. And our first collaboration had been Post Piano 1, the one being implicit at the time. And that was all based on the sound of one piano sample, a single piano note that we then sort of stretched out into a whole album, this one little tiny fragment of sound. And when we came to work on the sequel, I had actually gotten my old childhood acoustic piano back. And I had room in my apartment in Upper Manhattan to have this piano there, and I was very excited to use it. But the acoustics of the environment were not so good. I lived right by the elevated tracks of the 1-9 train, and so every, 7 to 10 minutes, you'd have a train go by incredibly loudly. There was traffic off of Broadway coming across the Broadway Bridge. This was on 218th Street in Inwood. And it was a sonically terrible space to work with. And I said, the only way I'm going to be able to use this piano is to work with the issues of this space and to work with these sounds that are there. So what I ended up doing for the piano sketch was to do a lot of very low-tech recordings that emphasize the acoustic properties of the space, keeping the train in, keeping the things that happened in, so that the album became as much about the environment in which these source recordings were made as the notes of the piano that I'm playing. And on top of that, I added a lot of other things. I did different types of recordings. Some of them were very high tech with very nice mics. Some of them were into really, really crummy cassette recorders. So there's different qualities to the different sounds and in terms of the recording quality. And all these then went through a whole nother layer of processing digitally, through sort of digitally recreated spaces using an impulse response reverb. So there's both the natural sounds and a couple layers of artifice in there, which leads us to the piece. And do you want to say a little bit about the piece? Because you did work with it.
Let's listen, and then let's talk a little bit.
I don't think we should listen to the whole thing. Do you want to listen? I mean, it's like 20 minutes. Do we
want to let's listen to why don't you play a little
I'll
bit?
I'll play a little bit until we get bored. So here we go. Let me find this thing.
Where is that?
So that was, I should probably mention the title of the piece. That was just an excerpt from it. It's about 20 minutes long. It's called November 11th, 2003. Very cryptically, I titled everything by date, which is confusing even for me. Mm-hmm. But what you heard there were some, you know, very simple piano patterns ripped off from the great Morton Feldman, and juxtaposed with these very dirty recordings, which I think, Andy, we want to talk a little bit about.
Yeah, I think that piece, as we were playing it, November 11th piece mix, touches on all three areas that it sort of occurred to me were interesting to talk about in terms of this idea of pushing extra musical or sort of framing elements, things that are normally considered peripheral to recording and to music, mm-hmm. bringing those to the center, sort of reversing this polarity in a way. And the first is what we were talking at the very beginning, this idea of extra musical sound,
right.
or the space for sound becoming much more than just the container, mm-hmm. but an actual mm-hmm. part of the fabric. Yeah. In this, it just feels like you have a piano that's a sound in and of itself. But you are treating the composition as a fabric,
right.
Of sound and space in general.
And one of the things with this piece that you really hear is there's this huge contrast between the silence, in quotation marks, you know, within the recordings, and then the digital black between the different recordings.
That's right.
And there's I spent a lot of time, as I do with all the pieces, crafting the silences themselves, getting the duration and the rhythm and the feel of them right. And that actually, in some ways, becomes harder than the actual notes, which are easy to sort of improvise and find interesting harmonic patterns. But when you're trying to feel the flow of absence, you know, that can be very challenging. And that was a big part of this piece, of knowing sort of when to cut those moments of static or, you know, out and bring a new sound in.
Yeah, well, the role of silence in music, I think you're talking about being influenced by Feldman. So, I mean, how would you describe that? For instance, like I'm interested in the way, you know, an acoustic silence is entirely different than a digital silence when you're creating a piece. What is your sense for the way those things...
Well, I mean, in this particular piece, when I'm talking about acoustic silence, you're talking about you're hearing the medium itself. You're hearing the recording medium. So if it was recorded on cassette, or you're hearing even in a cleaner mode, you're hearing the room tone that's there, it gets you in touch with the tactility of it, the technology that's mediating the process. Whereas the digital silences, the real silences in the piece, are absence. There's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole... And, of course, even the composition itself is so sparse. There's so little going on, one note at a time, essentially, with just the resonances of them fading out, that's almost a different mode of absence and presence that's sort of going back and forth there. And that's something which, you know, which I work with a lot in my work, and that does come from Feldman, exactly as you say, where Feldman, for me, is someone who... He makes a very musical use of silence. I mean, you think about Feldman and Cage. And Cage is a conceptualist, and his uses of silence are very much the concept and the idea of absence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas with Feldman, silence really becomes a compositional element. And I think that it's a good conversation for you and I to have, because a lot of these questions, I think you also take a more conceptual approach, where you bring about the idea and you bring that to the foreground
mm-hmm.
of it, where... Mm-hmm. I'm, at least in terms of when I'm doing the work myself, I'm less interested in the ideas and more interested in how it becomes a part of the actual piece of music itself,
mm-hmm.
Which is a different approach to take, which I think you also see, again, with the parallel with Cage and Feldman. They both had different approaches to the same questions, which is what makes them both interesting.
Yeah, what you're bringing up about this conceptual difference makes sense, and actually maybe leads into a piece that I could play. It makes me think... I used the location sound mm-hmm. for a series of sculptures at the Storm King Sculpture Park.
Ah, okay.
A large part of which of this acreage mm-hmm. of this outdoor sculpture park is devoted to these large scale minimalist sculpture works
mm-hmm.
that Richard Serra, large plates or planes of heavy material placed into the landscape that require a certain amount of distance or context or environment in order to operate mm-hmm. really, really appropriately, because they really they're supposed to be metering or modulating space and attention mm-hmm. in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, on one hand, it's really wonderful to have the space like at the sculpture park to get that distance or to get that time or the volume of space. Mm-hmm. Well, I was very interested in the way that the minimalist impulse in general is toward context, mm-hmm. and toward not dissolving, but of leaning a material into its whole and holistic kind mm-hmm. of context, both within time and within the space of its presentation. And that started me thinking about the way sound might operate that way, mm-hmm. In that when you take a location recording, it is essentially context,
yeah.
And materializing that context. And I thought it would be really nice to take this sort of frame of sound around these objects. And so I went to these large, you know, Richard Serra plate piece, let's mm-hmm. say, on the side of a hill, took the recording, and then made essentially a piece of music concrete out of these different locations mm-hmm. as a way of sort of making a material out of the context again, kind of now, reversing that flow in a way.
Yeah, as
which
a
was
question.
Entirely a kind of a conceptual
right, exactly.
gesture.
Exactly.
But, yeah.
As a question, are you processing the material further, or are you just presenting it as it occurred as a phenomenon?
Well, that's what kind of I ended up thinking about yeah. was this idea of when you're working with steel,
yeah.
as
yeah.
It's as solid as yeah. it wants to be. It's a plastic material.
Yeah.
And to be working with sound in the digital domain, or in tape or whatever, when you're working with a concrete sound, it essentially has that kind of plasticity.
Mm-hmm.
So I can play yeah, part or all of it. It's a pretty short piece. This is called Untitled Weathering Steel, which is the material that
like
all the Serra pieces were made from.
Yeah. This is my piece, actually.
Oh, it's doing it again.
Everybody
out there. Faked you out.
There we go. Okay. That was Andy Graydon. And Andy has reminded me while we were listening to that that I actually remastered this piece for him, which I'd forgotten.
That's right. It was
this is a new museum installation, and he wanted it to go up to 11.
It needed to
face the space. And
because speaking of the context for pieces, it was in a situation where they had not really considered the presentation of sound work within the gallery situation.
Yeah. It was getting lost in the space itself in a way. So we made it a lot louder, which is not something ethically we like to do with high quality recordings, because there's the loudness wars and all these issues of if music is overcompressed these days. But I put aside those ethical qualms for Andy so he could be loud at the new museum.
Which ended up being, there's that fine line between being wanting to be subtle and fold into a situation. The difference between that and just not being heard, because you're interested. Well, in this case, you're in a visual arts situation.
That's right, yeah.
And aural elements tend to get just folded into a kind of an audiovisual.
Well, this brings me to the question that I wanted to ask you, which was to talk about the conceptual aspects of this. And many people in approaching, the question of what is music and what is sound art is very complex, and we're not going to answer that here. But the question of when you're approaching a work like this, which is essentially intertextual, it's about the relationship between a space in which it was recorded and another work of art. This, to me, puts it towards the continuum, along the continuum of sound art. And yet, when people approach a recording, all they're receiving is essentially the recording itself. They're not necessarily getting this information. Mm-hmm. How do you go about communicating the conceptual aspects of your work when people aren't used to reading, essentially, along with listening to a recording?
Yeah. Well, I think what you're talking about by calling it intertextual is exactly right, that I think within sound art, one of the important things is that you are creating partial objects.
Yeah.
And that, in fact, in this case, this piece was in the new museum. It was partly confounded by all of this noise and this inattention, but it was also very much created by it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it did really only function by virtue of the fact that it became complicated within a system of actual sculptural objects that were part of the show, which was the way and the kind of the concept by which the sounds were created, and then that it was also in a complicated listening situation.
Yeah.
How that makes it a more clear statement of the ideas, I can't say, except that in certain of these things, all you can do is present something emblematically of the way that it should be received.
Right. But I guess the question is, like, do you want to have somehow a written text that goes along with this piece? So, does that make it easier or a spoken text explaining it? Does that clarify the meaning?
I think the answer is yes. Yeah. A lot of these things if you are able to encounter them more than once in different ways, then that's an advantage. So, for instance, this is a piece that would be on CD, but was also meant to be presented in public.
Right.
There will always be, there might be a blurb about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that also outside of that, I think repetition is the key.
Okay.
In that a standalone work sort of makes a certain presentation and might open a space or a space of questioning or of certain issues, like why does this sound, for instance, like field recordings, and yet is clearly not.
Right, right.
It's clearly not documentary. It's clearly not a thing, or it's not this thing, it's not this thing.
Yeah.
But it's not quite musical either. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, then through a series of encounters with either through more pieces in the same vein by the same person, by me, or through a sort of a longitudinal thing with other people, that those meanings will kind of sift out.
Okay. And, you brought up the question of field recordings, which we were just talking about with Tom in the break while the piece was playing. And you know, what is the role of the field recording? It's almost like there's, like we talk about a continuum between sound, art, and music. There's this tension in two directions with field recordings, where there's some people who it's very much a documentary impulse that goes to it, where you're capturing something that has taken place in the world and leaving it, in a sense, untouched, to document that moment that took place sonically somewhere. And then on the other hand, we put these into the computers and into all these wonderful tools we have, and they become raw material, and they're plastic and they're malleable, and you can create wonderful new things out of them. And I think that's a question with field recordings, and where do you... Clearly, you've processed this material a lot. It didn't sound like that at the Serapis. What are your thoughts on that continuum?
Well, it reminds me of why one of the reasons I'm really interested in acoustic ecology.
Because how do you define acoustic ecology?
That is a thorny and an ongoing thing, and that's why I'm interested in it, is because in a lot of ways, and I'm not trying to be essentialist about this, but in a lot of ways, it is about... about the complicated sonic environment, and a lot of projects that deal with acoustic ecology are about preserving and the debate about how to represent situations and contexts of sound. But when I think about that, I'm always much more interested in the speculative nature of these environments, right? Mm-hmm. So and of the transformational properties or abilities of transformational possibilities, which in the case of sound or field recordings, you have what could be taken for a thing, taken for a place, taken for this. But hearing works in very complicated ways. There's musical hearing, there's navigational hearing, there's linguistic
conceptual
hearing.
Exactly.
So, and you can listen to a sound object or a sound text from through many different pathways, let's say, and the especially digital tools allow this allow you to open the speculative possibilities and transform one thing into the other. For instance, what I mean is transform a location, like an outdoor location of anything, of the cicadas or of the wind that was at the sculpture park, allow you to transform that into musical structure,
right,
of one kind or another.
And then that opens questions that, like we were just talking about, of how tied that is to the conceptual underpinnings of the work. Do you need to know what the location was, the meaning of it, the significance of it for the artist, or its resonance within the piece, or does it become pure abstract sound? And those are two different directions that artists work in, I think. I've done a whole series of pieces where I take sounds of New York City streets and twist them into whole new things, and you don't necessarily need to know that the New York City streets. Sometimes that might give you added understanding or not, but at least what I was aiming for was to bring out some latent musicality in it.
I've heard at least one of the pieces that you're talking about, and which I really love.
Is it the one with the date?
It's that one that has a date for a title.
Yeah, I know that
let
one.
Let me think.
Yeah. Can you hum a few bars?
But I know it was taken in downtown Manhattan.
Right, yeah, that's...
And it has a very ephemeral, in times of quality, very concrete quality in different places. It is kind of, it has a sort of ghostly imprint in general. And so, but at the same time, I feel like that has that sense, well, it's sort of conceptual in a way, but it can be read as a terrain.
Yeah, well, that's...
On its own.
I think the piece you're talking about is May something or other, 2001, May 6, if I'm not mistaken, which is actually the title of the And/Or album that features a bunch of remixes of it. And that piece, the concepts are, give you a whole other layer of resonance, because that piece was recorded on May 6, 2001, but it was recorded in the financial district of Lower Manhattan. I went out for a walk on a Sunday evening, and I really recommend that you go down there on a Sunday evening, because it's totally deserted. It's the only time you can get field recordings in New York City, without people talking or cars going by, because there's nobody there. All the bankers are gone, and you're in these narrow canyons amidst these incredibly tall buildings, and it's just amazing sounds. And I went down there with a very low tech field recorder and did what was part of for me at the time a fairly routine series of pieces that I was working on. But the resonance changed, of course, because one of the paths that I walked along as I walked around the World Trade Center. And later that year, that space was irrevocably changed. And that changed the meaning of the piece. And it's why we ended up doing that album of different artists interpreting it. Because then there was this conceptual layer that got put over what, at the time, I was trying to do was a purely tactile piece. Like, hey, here's a chance to get the streets in New York without cars and people talking. What does it sound like? And instead it became a much more conceptual project.
Yeah.
So these things go, they go back and forth.
Do you have that? Do you
want unless we have an internet connection. I'm afraid I didn't bring it with me. Although, who knows, maybe it's on the shelf here somewhere. I've got other stuff we can play, take us in other directions. I mean, what else do we want?
Why don't you play something else?
I can play we'll do the and now for something completely different. Talking about framing, and I'll try to tie this into what we're talking about, and silence. You know, this is a piece.
Yeah, maybe silence.
That, yeah, this is a silence-themed piece. This is a piece called, let's have a look, it's November 18th, 2004. It's fairly short. I feel like it's about 4 or 5 minutes. This is a piece where I'm really engaging with a lot of silence. And my wife, Wendy, had a very good question as we were getting ready to do the show where she said, well, if you're going to do so much about silence, how are people, if they're just tuning in, how are they going to know that the station is going? And it's a fair question if you tune in. In fact, as Andy was trying to cue this piece before, he started skipping through it and he didn't hear anything. He kept skipping again and skipping again. I'm like, you can't skip through this piece because it's pretty much all silence. There's a couple little moments of sound.
I'll just stand on the microphone and say, this is the silence.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we have. You need like a little thing. You know, do not adjust your radio. Yes. anyway, so this is a piece that's very much about silence. It's about this juxtaposition between very simple sonic objects spread across silence. And you know, one thing that I said with this piece, I was talking about it at one point, and to me, the silences in this piece are like the ginger that you eat between pieces of sushi. You know, it's to clear your palate. You know, you get hit with this complex sound, which is challenging if because maybe it's strange or unusual or harmonically complex or just weird that it's sitting there. And then you've got a moment to sort of pause and regroup and to wonder what's coming next. And I think one of the things that I was trying to achieve with this piece, which I don't think succeeds, I don't think it's one of my better works, but it's interesting in its failure, is that I was trying to do a piece completely without repetition. I rely a lot on repetition in my work. I grew up under minimalism. You know, my hero is Morton Feldman. You know, there's a lot. I grew up on 80s pop music. I mean, there's a lot of repetition in all that. And you depend on that as a way of creating meaning in music. And that's a double-edged sword because it could be a way of creating, you know, of failing to find new modes of meaning. And I was really trying to push myself at this point in my work, and I think unsuccessfully because I didn't find a formula that got me through it, to find a way to work, to write without repetition. And so nothing in this piece repeats. Every sound happens only once. It's one object, gone, space, next object. And for that, the silence was really necessary because otherwise you can get overwhelmed by it and beaten down by the complexity. You still want the piece to be graspable in a sense. And I think silence aids in that. But let's play the piece and we can, you can talk about it a little bit more. Let me push the button here. Thank you. So you can hear the noise and room tone come up as mm-hmm. as we fade in there. As I'm listening to that, I was reminded of a story I wanted to tell, which was many years ago. I had the new release from Line, and you know, Line is a sub-label of 12K. Line's run by Richard Chartier, and I was listening to at the time was a new artist who I didn't know, Ralph Steinbruchel. His first release online, and you know, I didn't know Ralph at the time, and I didn't know his work, and so I put it on my CD player, little CD Walkman, and I sit down to listen to this new person from Line, and I hit play, and it's very sparse, very minimal, and it plays a little more, and I'm not getting it, I'm not understanding it, and I just start to get more and more angry. I say, what is Richard thinking releasing this? This is so minimal that it's just not even making sense to me. It's so sparse. There's so much silence. And I'm just totally frustrated and fed up. And I look at the CD player to check how far in I am, and I realize the batteries are dead. It's not playing. You know, and only in a genre like ours could you. Exactly. And then, of course, I got new batteries and played it. It's a lovely album.
But so noisy.
Exactly, yes. Well, these are the questions, you know, that are raised by stuff like this. And I know you want to talk a little bit about silence, so...
Well, I mean, I just think it's very interesting, a piece like this, that you talk about the fact that there is no repetition, but of course the repetition is in the silence.
Oh, that's right. I never thought of that. That's a great idea.
That you have, and of course that seems to be the bulk of the piece.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the dominant.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what I find is that instead of no noise, mm-hmm. The sound becomes the suggestion or the impulse to attention.
Right.
It forces you back onto thinking about the structure of a piece,
mm-hmm.
and you think about the time that you're spending, let's say,
right.
on a piece of music, that you then you are so. I find that I'm constantly reorienting myself to this
mm-hmm.
piece,
yeah.
not because of the sound,
right.
Although, like you say, that it does sort of there's a certain palate cleansing
yep.
Element that just has to do with attention.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing which you know I struggle with in my own pieces like this is that I want on the one hand to evoke questions like that in people, but to me I also want it to work as a piece of music, and that's always the fine line which I'm walking. You know, it's mm-hmm. like I sometimes I like this piece and sometimes I don't, and sometimes I think it doesn't cohere musically because I don't just want it to be an intellectual exercise. I want it to be what you traditionally look at from a piece of music, which is whatever a musical experience is. You know, I don't know what that is, but whatever
right.
it is.
Right.
And so I'm kind of torn with a piece like this because I feel like it, as an exercise, it works and it was something I needed to do at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped me in the questions that I was asking. I don't know if it didn't end up starting a line of new pieces. I didn't end up continuing in this direction. I ended up sort of trying other ideas and such. You know, so it's again this tension, this push and pull between sort of the intellectual and conceptual aspects of the work and just the emotional or musical or tactile or physical aspects.
Yeah.
And I think we want to, from there, talk about this piece of yours, yes?
Sure, yeah. Indeed. We were going to talk about this piece that I did. Again, going back to this, the difference between a kind of certain material approaches or the way that material can be applied to a conceptual approach.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited to be part of a series of releases by White Line Editions, a micro label out of the UK. The series was called Arcasonics, and the dictum was simply to make a sound piece that was in some way related to architecture,
mm-hmm.
and specifically. If it could be related to certain forms or certain buildings or structures or architects and as a kind of a translational process, an
mm-hmm.
idea of music and the possibility of translation. I know that a lot of people are interested in the relationship between music and architecture as a kind of a scoring translation.
Yeah,
as a blueprint,
yep.
A blueprint operating as a kind of score, a score operating as a kind of spatial arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't end up being so interested in that that way into the idea
mm-hmm.
as I am the way spaces, both real or imagined or how space itself forms sound,
mm-hmm.
but also the way acoustic sound forms the actual character of space, but also the ability for people to navigate in space. In other words, a kind of social space. So when I was asked to do this, one of the buildings that I have passed along quite a bit and seen a lot in Berlin since I've lived there for the last 9 months is the new National Gallery in Berlin. And it's a very iconic structure in that it's a Mies van der Rohe building that where he is playing with absolute transparency. So you're looking out across a completely flat, a very large, completely flat plaza, and there appears to simply be a very heavy steel roof floating in space above the plaza, because it is simply being floated up on glass and very narrow iron struts. And so the idea is that I think he's going for is of a completely transparent building. Of course, the thing that always gets that I always see about it is the hovering giant roof.
Yeah, that's about
which
to fall on
appears
you.
Like at any moment, like as if if Mies were to stop concentrating, it would collapse.
I had that experience with the Richard Serra pieces, which you were just talking about, where I feel like they're going to fall on me, even though I know he's done the math and it's not going to fall.
But I'm
afraid.
I think that there's actually something there which I haven't unpacked yet, is that I am very interested in these building structures that apply a very particular form of kind of phenomenal pressure upon a space.
And designers
or people who are working with space, and sound has a lot to do with this, because sound is always, if nothing else, it is always a pressure on an environment.
That is certainly true.
And there's no static sound. It always has to be flushing through a place. It always has to be exciting it and agitating it very literally. So anyway, this building was very interesting to me because in a certain sense, it doesn't exist visually, but it certainly exists orally. There's an inside and an outside sound-wise to this space. So what I did was I made recordings of the building as a sort of a conceptual starting point.
Okay.
And then I decided to take these recordings of the traffic noise, basically, once they were made, and decided to try and work with this idea of the floor and the ceiling, the only two things you could see, and to treat the floor and the ceiling from the standpoint of frequency, and one thing that you'll notice when you're working a lot with digital audio is it's very easy through transformations of sound to accidentally create very very low tones below the threshold of hearing and very very high digital noise.
Stuff for the enjoyment of your pets.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That make your dogs bark, and then your CD master is crazy.
Yeah.
So that's all to say that this is how the piece came about, and that it ends up being a piece with no middle, also, and that I was trying to approach this idea of transparency and the parallel between sound and sort of architectural form.
Okay.
So this is called Untitled Altbau.
Okay, I'm going to fade out the noise first, so we can focus on.
Okay. So we were listening to almost all of a piece called Untitled Altbau. And what we were just mentioning was we were talking about sound compression, for one thing, and how it can represent the highs and the lows. But it brought up this idea that I had to spend a lot of time in this piece just figuring out how I could handle the very low sound so that it would have this feeling of a real physicalized
mm-hmm.
pressure,
mm-hmm.
but that it wouldn't over-modulate the gear.
Yeah, so your
it wouldn't
doesn't
just create
explode.
A distortion.
Yeah.
I think sort of moving out of this idea of kind of space or silence, one thing we have talked about a couple of times that you brought up a couple of times are releases that you have done, both the Post Piano 2 album and this May 9th?
May 6th, 2001. It's one of those dates, the one with the dates.
That are compositions or records that you put together that have either in the context of the actual CD that was released or in a kind of an extracurricular kind
yes.
of activity,
yeah.
you might say, have been opened up to reworking, reinterpretation, remixing, to a community of other
right.
artists.
The social space that surrounds it, essentially. Yeah, I mean, the first one that came out like that was actually the first Post Piano album, where I've always been very interested in these, issues of intellectual property and alternatives to copyright and sharing of things and sort of abstract collaboration. And one of our ideas with the first Post Piano album was that not only were we going to release the album, but we were going to release everything that we wanted, everything that we had used to build it. So that it started from one sample. We included that sample on a data portion of the CD. We included my sketches that I had done, from which Taylor built the later pieces as MP3s, so that you had basically everything there to sort of build your own, essentially. And then we released it under an open license. This was before Creative Commons, and it was on something called the Open Music License, which was sort of an earlier version of that. And then when we got to Post Piano 2, we wanted to continue that theme. And so at that point, Creative Commons had sort of taken off, and we went with the Creative Commons as the license. But what we decided to do was this thing called which we ended up calling the Post Piano 2 Open Remix Project, or PP2ORP.
It rolls off the tongue.
It really does. The ORP. And we said, Taylor and I said, look, the whole idea of this, and we had gotten some people who had remixed or reworked the material from the first Post Piano, and that was really our intention, was we wanted people to build, new things. I think that's how we actually first heard of Sawako, was that she sent me these bossa nova tracks that she'd done. Really, I'm sorry, Japanese bossa. From Post Piano? I mean, it was Japanese bossa nova with little bits of Post Piano thrown in. I'm like,
nice.
Wow, and already I was like, wow, this Sawako, who is this person? We wanted to sort of continue that and sort of emphasize that this was to us a part of this whole project, was opening it up to other people. So we came up with the ORP idea, and we were very nervous about this because we thought people would kind of laugh at us or something. And we wrote put together an email, and we were going to send it out to the 12K mailing list and say, look, we invite people to remix this, to create new pieces, and we'll curate a selection and, put together a release on Term, which is 12K's online component, of whatever we think is best. And we were very afraid that we would not get enough responses to put together an email. To put together a release. That just no one would reply to the email, or the two or three people would, and it would be terribly embarrassing. And it was, in fact, the total opposite. We ended up getting over 100 pieces sent to us from all over the world. And many of them were just absolutely terrible.
It's not the direction I thought you were going to go with
yes,
that, with
no,
that
and
sentence.
It was incredibly inspiring to see all these people doing things with your work. And a lot of it's just really bad. And a lot of it was amazing. And that was the thing that was so striking, is that, you go through all of these, literally 100 things. And some are just incredible, just taking in totally different directions than you expect. Mm-hmm. We literally spent a whole summer listening to these. And I remember I just had a notepad and I had all of these things once we'd gotten them, and just listening over and over and taking notes, because when so many people put so much work into it, you want to kind of be a good curator and live up to it, and get a good selection and really do a conscientious job reviewing this stuff. And so we took tons of notes and we just started debating with each other out of how to build a release out of this. And we decided that we were going to limit it to 20 tracks. And in the end, we managed 20 out of, 100. And in the end, we got to 20 tracks and we just kept fighting. We couldn't decide on what was going to be that 20th track. And he was a partisan of one and I was a partisan of the other. And we're arguing for this or that. Finally said, you know what? It's an online release. It's going to be 21 tracks. That's how we settled it. And it's still on the 12K website. You can go to 12K.com and look for Term and you'll see the PP2 ORP. And Andy is one of the people on there. Mm-hmm. Andy submitted a very excellent track called Cloister. Mm-hmm. That's the name. That's what mm-hmm. I thought.
Cloister, and then the date that I completed my remix.
Oh, yes. I don't know where you got that idea from.
Yeah.
great. And so it was a great project. I mean, it was really inspiring. You see what people can do with stuff like this. And this is sort of an ongoing aspect of my own work where I release it all on my website. You know, mm-hmm. everything is freely available. And I encourage people to do whatever they want with it. And you know, I get emails. I get people sending me CDs. I get random stuff, you know, of all these really unexpected uses, which is really just incredibly inspiring, whether you like the end result or not. It's just great to see that you can create material that, you know, that goes on to live its life and somebody does something new with it and inspires someone to keep creating something different. So,
well, I was going to ask you what the importance for you was in releasing your music essentially as a kind of a tool or a code or something more than an inspiration.
Yeah.
But I think you're starting to answer that.
Yeah. It's a literalization of the process that has always been what music is about. I mean, the fact that we can do this technologically now doesn't mean that it wasn't what was happening in Bach's day, you know? Mm-hmm. Music is a force that flows through people, you know, from person to person and generation to generation, and it's being constantly transformed in that flow. Yeah. You can see it more directly now because I can take a sound and I can put it on my website and somebody I never met can grab it and build something new with it and take it in a totally different direction. But that's just an acceleration of a process that was already there, in the same way that the internet is just a really fast library where you don't have to walk through the stacks. You know?
Well, the sense that a recording does not dampen or deaden or the object or that flow, it simply materializes and allows it to become very tactile.
That's a very important point because I think that there was a time in the relationship between music and the recording where that it was an adversarial stance, you know, where people who had lived for the entire history of human life hearing music only as a live phenomenon.
Yeah.
And when recordings came in, people said, recordings are dead. You know, it's this dead thing. It's a reproduction. It's not real. And I'd like to think that we've reached a point now with the fluidity of recordings where you see that recordings are just as alive as any form of music.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why the Creative Commons is a very fascinating and seems like a very vital thing to be attending to at this point in time, because I think the one thing that keeps that sort of deadened nature or that sort of the in place is the radically enforced copyright.
Right.
Because it puts a consumer into the attitude of simply a consumer.
That's right.
That you don't take a recording, you don't take a program as something that you can actually directly respond to or directly create from and with and through. But rather that somehow you're supposed to receive it.
Yes,
which I think
is
really funny.
As a physical object that you hold on to.
Yeah, and then somehow in your head it becomes something else.
Yeah.
And somehow it's sort of cleaned and becomes pure.
Yeah.
And then if you create something that sort of, quote, references it, then that's okay.
Yes.
But heaven forbid you actually try to use a part of the thing.
Yeah.
Which just, it does seem sort of disingenuous given the way we work and are able to use technology.
Yeah, and again, and it's just an acceleration of a process that's always been going on. Mm. Because, you know, all music, all art is theft. Mm-hmm. All art is borrowing, and it's looking at the things that inspire you. And that's what inspiration is to love a piece of art, if you're an artist, is to grab a piece of it,
that's right.
You know, and do something with it. I mean, one of the pieces of music I brought today, which we certainly won't have time to play all of, is Feldman's Piano and String Quartet.
Oh, yeah.
And I've spent, you know, I heard that for the first time in 1993, and it immediately destroyed my life. And I've spent all these years since just trying to copy it. And I'm now working on a piece that's the closest copy I've done yet, and it's still just a copy. I'm reminded, you know, the Borges story.
Absolutely.
Pierre Menard.
I was going to ask you. you ever thought about that?
And I was thinking
rewriting the Quixote.
Exactly. And to clarify, if you don't know this story, it's a wonderful Borges story it's a fake review, essentially, that he's written about this writer, Pierre Menard, whose lifetime project is to essentially rewrite Don Quixote by Cervantes.
But to rewrite it originally again.
Exactly. That's exactly right. It's not a matter of copying the words. It's a matter of learning Spanish and living as if he were in Cervantes' day and learning the culture and basically re-experiencing the act of creation.
And of course, the story is told from a critic's standpoint,
yes,
and carefully explaining point by point why the new Quixote will be so much more
so much
brilliant
better
than the original.
and the brilliance of Borges is that he convinces you of
absolutely
this.
Absolutely.
I mean, you read the
convincing
story and you say, yeah, that new exact copy of the Quixote, it is infinitely richer.
yeah.
So that's my, I've been thinking a lot about that story in my relationship with the piano and string quartet, you know, because it's like, what am I trying to do exactly? I mean, I feel like if I could learn to do what Feldman did and totally re-experience it, maybe I get the thick glasses and a wig of long black hair and talk with a thicker Brooklyn accent, you know, or smoke cigarettes and scowl at the camera. And
It reminds me of how you know, sound performances or some presentations are often called diffusions.
Yes,
so sound
yeah
is always yeah diffused,
yeah,
and that if there can be the sense that you can use the term or that sense of diffusion without mm-hmm the connotation of watering down or disappearing,
well, that's right, yeah,
or becoming less.
Yeah.
That in turn reminds me of that 1,000 Peacock Feathers project.
Oh,
that
yeah,
was
with
done
the, with
by
the Russians.
I can't remember their names.
Dmitry Gelfand and Evelina Dominich.
Thank you, exactly.
AKA the Russians.
Who got in touch with, I don't remember if it was you first or me first.
I don't remember which of us, yeah. But
they wanted to use the remix that I did
right
of your
of my piece
for the post piano two
yes
thing in a in an installation
yep
that was then documented
yes
on I think a
DVD
line
and remixed
DVD
the piece further because when I
that's
heard
right
the piece I said that's it took me I was watching a
it's
bit of the thing
of my
and then it took
piece
a minute to say this sounds strangely familiar
mm-hmm
I'm like isn't this something Andy did? I'm
right
like, no, wait, it's something that Andy and I did.
So it was sort of third, fourth
yeah
order.
Yeah.
But I definitely had the same sense that yeah this was great.
Yeah.
That, in fact, it just kind of continued to pulse
yep
through this other work. And that, it carried through in a very positive
and
way.
And that's why, you know, I try not to get too depressed about, you know, my endless imitations of Feldman's piano and string quartet is because you never do it correctly.
That's right.
You'll never get it right. And the Borges example is this ideal of perfection that, of course, Borges is satirizing, that he can never
yeah
exactly rewrite Cervantes.
Yeah.
And in the process of trying to imitate, we accidentally create these new things.
Yeah.
And that's what the process of creativity and of art and whatever it is we do of music, you know, is all about, is our failures of imitation accidentally becoming these strange new things that start to pass around and flow and end up,
nice,
you know, becoming, as the Russians did, 10,000 peacock feathers in foaming acid,
yes,
which is
right
not what I was thinking when I wrote November 11th,
yeah, right,
2003.
Or Cloister,
yes,
or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Then Cloister. Like
what do you want to play next?
Oh, I don't know. I got a couple more things. You have stuff?
Why don't you cue something up?
Well, all right, I'll cue something up. Here's just a little piano-y thing that has a lot of silence. It's sort of almost kind of, this can tie back to Cage a little. It's kind of like a digitally prepared piano.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was never, no pianos were harmed in the making of this piece. There were no actual pianos involved. It's all an electronically created piano that's been electronically processed in a way that it sounds kind of like a Cajun prepared piano. And it also has a lot of silence and a lot of the sort of framing silences that, you know, I derive very much from Feldman. And it's short, which is nice. So we're going to play it. Oh, it's called October 23. What happened? What did I do? Here, Andy, you drive. I don't know what I did. I've done something to his computer.
You done did it now.
Oh, it's all over. Now I'm going to have to talk some more. Oh, no, it's back. Okay, so this is...
October 23rd, is that correct?
Yes, October 23rd. Here it goes. Thank you.
Thank you.
We got a little extra silence there at the end because we were chatting. Didn't we realize that it had ended? So what Andy's going to do is look for the piece, yes, on his hard drive?
Yeah, so we were just talking about this collaborations and the sort of social space that gets opened up when you release these pieces. We thought, well, why don't I go ahead and play, since you played at the beginning of the original piece, why don't I try to play Find?
Yeah. The Cloister remix that we were talking about. This was Andy's contribution to the PP2 ORP, the Post Piano 2 Open Remix Project.
And so I knew what you were interested in conceptually and materially with the piece that you had used as the source. Mm-hmm. And so what I was trying to do with the remix was what was released for the remix project was an MP3.
Do you want to have it playing now while you're talking?
Sure, good idea.
There it goes.
There we go.
You want me to turn it down or keep it going?
Oh, I
think it was actually playing. Oh, you don't have headphones. It was. Here, let's pause it.
I'm going to talk over it.
He's going to talk over it.
So basically, what we had was an MP3.
Yep.
Which, of course, has limit frequency and compression limitations of its own.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent my time on a very, very short piece of your long
fragment
piece,
of
a very very small fragment, just trying to mine it for the extra noise, and then placing that noise in
right.
different ways.
Yeah, yeah. So and it becomes very melodic, as you'll hear in Andy's piece. So let's sit and listen to it. This is Cloister something something 19 2000 and something.
Okay. That's right.
Okay. Thank you. So that was Andy Graydon, Cloister, which was based on, built from, I should say, the first piece that we played of mine this evening, which was November 11, 2003.
And that kind of brings us full circle.
I should also say that, you know, of Cloister is included in the Post Piano 2 Open Remix project, which is on the 12K website under the term section. And all the stuff of mine, which you've heard, can be downloaded from my website, which is kennethkirshner.com. Mm-hmm. You are andygraydon.net, if I'm not
mistaken, right? Andygraydon.net. I also would like to point out that, this Cloister piece is included on a Winds Measure release.
Oh, is it? That's right. At Bay. Yes,
at Bay. And I would just sort of give another shout out to Ben Owen and his Winds Measure imprint, which is continuing to do great things.
Yes. So, other than that, we'll just wrap it up. And we've worked out all the mysteries of music and sound art. And we want to thank Tom for this.
Yes,
it's been
thank you very much for coming on down.
And I think our concept here is that we're gonna fade out with my nemesis, the Piano and String Quartet by Feldman, which is a couple hours long, but we'll play as much as we can get away with. Yeah. So let me pull up that file, and thank you for listening, if there's anyone out there.
And we want to thank both Andy Graydon and Kenneth Kirshner for coming on down. This is free103.9.org, triangulation, free103.9.org.